Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, local drummer Rocky Moffitt visits the WILL studios and shows off a few unusual instruments. We hear about the Garlicky Greens Eating Championship, find out how one Illinois artist has been inspired by starlings, and we remember science fiction writer Philip Jose Farmer. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Cambridge, Massachusetts has been home to the annual Garlicky Greens Eating Championship since 2004. Known mostly as an amateur event, this year the contest was sanctioned by Major League Eating, the national organization that supervises all professional competitive eating events. So, with a handful of professional gurgitators stepping up to the plate, can the local competitors hold their own? Rebecca Shearer has the answer.
It's kind of like the story of David and Goliath. Only instead of armor and a shield bearer, this Goliath comes armed with a stomach that can bear 19 and a half hot dogs eaten in 10 minutes.
5.5 pounds of burritos in 10 minutes. 5 pounds of ramen noodles in 10 minutes and 32 crystal hamburgers in 8 minutes.
These are just some of the personal records of Pete Pretty Boy DeVicus.
I am a professional competitor of the eating discipline.
A Boston native.
I've heard you guys referred to as professional gurgitators.
Who's ranked 25th. In the competitive eating world.
Yeah, I was going to use that term. I just decided to switch it up a little bit.
Pretty Boy's been competing for 2 years.
It's my sport. Some guys golf on different courses. I eat different courses.
The course he's eating today is more of an appetizer. Sort of. It's garlic sautéed spinach, known here at local fast food eatery Be Good as Garlicky Greens. And the 6'1", 215-pound gurgitator will have 5 minutes to bolt down as much as he can in Be Good's 5th annual Garlicky Greens eating contest.
What are you aiming for today? What's your goal in terms of poundage of spinach?
As long as it's an ounce more than the next guy, I don't care.
One of those next guys, by the way, is this guy.
My name is Betsy's Boy, also known as Michael Cobb.
And at 5'10", 155 pounds.
I am of medium build, to be generous.
The undergraduate business student is far more David.
Have you done any other competitive eating competitions of any sort?
Than Goliath.
I haven't, actually.
Not that Betsy's Boy is a total newbie. Last year, he guzzled a record-breaking 3.25 pounds of Garlicky Greens.
Beating the closest contender by over 0.5 pound.
Earning himself the title of world champion.
And my prize was this exceptional Be Good wrestling belt and a year's worth of free burgers.
But that was back when the contest was amateur hour, or amateur 5 minutes, as the case may be. But this year?
I got an email from one of the pros who said, I want a shot at the title. What do I have to do?
The pro, as it happens, was one Pete Pretty Boy DeVicus. And turns out he didn't have to do anything. The one who did was this fellow.
John Olinto. I'm the co-founder of Be Good.
And in order for any pros to compete, John had to get the contest officially sanctioned.
We had to go through Major League Eating, which is this international confederation of eaters, right?
Right. A sports franchise, really, which oversees all professional eating events. And as such,
you need to have a stage.
There are certain rules.
You need an MC from Major League Eating.
You even need an EMT in case of, I kid you not,
stomach injury, esophagus damage, whatever it might be.
So John and his co-founder, Anthony Ackle, took care of all that and approached their customers and said,
listen, we have pros coming in to try to take what's ours, which is our family's belt. You know, like we're a family. You have to defend our honor.
And 8 members of the Be Good family have shown up to defend that honor today.
It is a battle of the ages, people! And it happens here, today, at this place, Be Good Real Food Real Fast!
They're competing against Pete DeVicus and Mike Springer, who's known for downing 80 chicken wings in 8 minutes.
We gather now upon the Mount Sinai of mastication. The Madison Square Garden of Gurgitation. So it is, and so it shall be! That's when you cheer.
Outside the restaurant, before an obviously awestruck crowd, the eaters take their marks behind 2 tables, each piled with 1-pound plates of Garlicky Greens. At the MC's signal,
3, 2, 1, begin eating!
They dig in, using their bare hands to shovel spinach into their mouths. and in some cases onto the eater next to them. Betsy's boy makes a valiant effort.
How is the defending champ doing? He's finishing, he's third.
But compared with Pretty Boy,
he's on seven.
There's not much he can do except...
Four, three, two, one! Stop eating! Stop eating! Stop eating!
In the end, Pretty Boy nabs first place with 7 pounds of spinach. Mike Springer places second with 5. And after polishing off a respectable 4 1/3 pounds...
which is 33% growth over 1 year.
Michael, Betsy's boy, Cobb...
You are a business student, aren't you?
...ties for third.
We try.
And he's more than ready to try again next year, he says. In the meantime, it appears this devouring David...
So, physically right now, how you feeling?
I'm okay. I'm okay.
...might be ready to trade his slingshot for a stomach of steel.
Word has it that Pete is going out for pizza now.
I think I'll pass on that. I might take a burger. I might do a burger. Pizza I'll pass on.
Well, almost anyway. I'm Rebecca Shear in Cambridge.
This is Sidetrack. In 1890, a wealthy Shakespeare admirer went to New York's Central Park and released 100 imported European starlings. His plan was to introduce into America all the birds mentioned in the works of Shakespeare. 100 years and 200 million starlings later, that plan is wildly successful and has inspired a Central Illinois artist to get the word out about the ubiquitous and invasive bird. From Normal, Laura Kennedy has more.
Carol Gilmore stands beneath a large sycamore tree in her parents' backyard on Bloomington's Old West Side, eyes lifting warily. Overhead, hundreds of European starlings swirl and surge in massive flocks, peppering the gray winter evening sky. The birds are in search of a roosting place for the night, and Gilmore knows just where they'll settle, right where they've roosted for too many nights before, in the old sycamore. Gilmore's not just tired of this nightly ritual, she's disgusted.
The smell, the odor, the mess, the smell, the displeasure at this whole thing. Now we're coming, see? Now we're coming. And we will probably get pooped on.
Great.
Get a step under the eaves
here.
It's that mess that the starlings leave on the ground that most has Gilmore concerned. The health hazards of hundreds of starling droppings leaves her family wary to venture into the backyard. As a result, she's tried a variety of tricks to scare off the enormous flocks.
We've tried bright lights. We've tried loud noise. We've tried firecrackers, banging pots and pans, and...
Nothing shifts them.
No. Maybe temporarily. But see, okay, we're definitely beginning. In the background, you hear the firecrackers going off.
I think in town you have to grin and bear it.
That's Jeannie Morse, the manager of Wild Birds Unlimited in Normal.
Because they are dependent on big trees to roost in.
Morse says that each autumn, starlings begin massing in huge flocks, where there's safety in numbers. And that's where a lot of enemies are made, like Carol Gilmore. But there are those who have been charmed by the bird, which is a distant cousin of the myna. Starlings made friends and influenced people in Europe by being able to imitate human speech. A quick search on YouTube reveals one particularly vocal starling named Liberty.
I'm a starling. My name is Liberty. Make a donation. Make a donation. I'm an invasive species. Make a donation.
Artist Brian Collier of Bloomington became intrigued by the starlings when he noticed them massing in a giant tree outside his studio window.
So I was just struck. I would walk out of the back of the building and you could smell the birds and you could like feel the presence of just thousands and thousands of animals.
What was a nuisance to Carol Gilmore was an inspiration to Collier.
Most people think of these animals as these horrible pests, right? So what could we do to sort of shift that image a little bit and turn them into a productive tool? And so I thought if we started this program that would teach them all to say the name of the man who introduced them to North America, we could actually turn them into this incredible environmental teaching tool.
Collier wants everyone to be a part of his art project, Teach the Starlings. He distributes informational postcards throughout the communities that host his project, detailing the history behind the starling in North America and Shakespeare fan Eugene Schieflin's environmental no-no.
One of the central pushes of the project is to invite people to actually do this. This isn't me doing this. This is me inviting other people to go out in their environment and shout Schieflin at starlings. And hopefully, the larger the numbers of people doing this, the more likely that the starlings will actually learn.
Collier is also teaching straight to the source. Playing on the starlings' ability to mimic human speech, the project includes nesting boxes and suet feeders with motion trigger audio players inside.
And so as the starling enters and exits the nest box, the audio player plays Schieflin inside the box.
So I see the suet feeder.
So the starling will fly up to it and
Schieflin.
Trigger that.
Schieflin.
So far, Collier hasn't heard any of the starlings emerging from the box say Schieflin, but one day he was sitting on his back porch.
And I heard people in the back alley saying, Schieflin, Schieflin, Schieflin. And I found two of my neighbors shouting at a starling sitting on a power line because they had found this card at the coffee shop and they had no idea it was me.
Collier contends he's not advocating for the starling. Rather, he's trying to educate people. Jeannie Morris of Wild Birds Unlimited says that's not a bad idea. She says it wasn't by choice that the starling came to America and that we need to remember the European settlers who came here long ago and displaced many Native Americans. They, too, can be considered an invasive species.
A lot of us have white Anglo-Saxon heritage, so if you take that in context and compare it to what the starling has done, I think it just makes you a little more understanding.
So long as the starlings continue to fill her family's sycamore, Carol Gilmore is a long way from understanding.
I would not be one of those folks that are going to love starlings, ever.
Schieflin! Schieflin!
I'm Laura Kennedy.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. When science fiction writer Philip Jose Farmer died last month at the age of 91, the newspaper in Peoria where he lived printed an affectionate tribute. But Farmer's death received even bigger play in the New York Times and newspapers around the world. During his 40 years of active writing, Phil Farmer showed that the rules of genre writing were made to be broken. Jim Meadows, during his years at Peoria Public Radio Station WCBU, interviewed Farmer at various times. Some of those interviews were included in this remembrance.
I first interviewed Philip Jose Farmer in 1989 in the book-lined basement study of his Peoria home. Farmer was then in his early 70s, and he was telling me about one of his most famous short stories, written more than 20 years earlier in the mid-1960s.
Well, at that time, I was reading a document, or a manifesto, really, called the Triple Revolution Document. This was put out by a bunch of people, such as Tom Hayden and others, who maintained that there was enough abundance in this world so that nobody had to go hungry. But due to the effort on the part of the people who control food to make a big profit due to embargoes, import duties and so forth, and due to lack of cooperation among nations, we don't have enough food, we don't have enough decent housing. They maintained that something could be done about this.
Around that same time, the young writer Harlan Ellison was commissioning stories for Dangerous Visions, a massive anthology intended to shatter science fiction taboos, political, stylistic, and sexual. Farmer wrote a story that aimed to shatter all three.
So having just read the Triple Revolution document and thought about it, I immediately got this idea of a title called Riders of the Purple Wage, derived, of course, from Zane Grey's Western, Riders of the Purple Sage. But the Purple Wage would be guaranteed minimum income for all members of society, whether they worked or not. Then I projected the society to, I think it was 2216 in Beverly Hills, conceived of a society that had developed out of the Triple Revolution document. It was sort of Joycean, or maybe I should say Lewis Carolian, because it contained a lot of puns, some of them very subtle, some of them pretty gross. But the main object of the story was to show the difficulties that an artist might have in this future society.
The young artist in Purple Wage, Chib Winnigan, decides that the only way to keep his artistic integrity is to drop out of society, refusing the Purple Wage that subsidizes him. The story reflects Farmer's ambivalence about the Triple Revolution document. He feared that the price of a society that guarantees food and shelter for all might be a paternalistic government that squashes freedom and individual initiative. Roosevelt University professor and science fiction critic Gary Wolfe was a longtime friend of Farmer. He says Purple Wage was by far the most successful and controversial story in the Dangerous Visions anthology.
It was part pulp, part vaudeville, part Joyce, part social philosophy, and all mixed together in this phantasmagorical set of imagery that I think today would be a lot less controversial. Even today, though, I think the story still startles people when they read it because of the amount of stuff going on.
Philip Jose Farmer first made his reputation as a science fiction rule breaker with his first science fiction publication. In 1952, his story The Lovers dealt frankly with sexual themes and won him a Hugo, the award voted on by science fiction fans for excellence in the genre. Riders of the Purple Wage earned Farmer his second Hugo. His third would come 5 years later. In a 1992 interview, Farmer said the idea for his Riverworld series grew from his interest in the works of Mark Twain, the life of 19th-century British explorer Sir Richard Francis Burton, and a fascination with themes of immortality, the afterlife, and ethics.
I don't remember the exact day. Actually, I think it was around 1951. I suddenly envisioned an afterlife, which was not supernatural, but had been created by physical means, by alien people who actually form a background of the mystery. The essence of the story is that all humanity from about 100,000 BC to 1983 have been resurrected by physical means along the banks of this immense 18 million mile long river, which is on one planet.
The first Riverworld novel, To Your Scattered Bodies Go, earned Farmer his third Hugo in 1971. In that book and its four sequels, the tale of billions of people mysteriously brought back to life on another planet gave Farmer the opportunity to explore more ideas about what people will do when they don't have to struggle to survive.
They are provided with all their basic necessities. They don't have to worry about going to work or raising food or getting enough food. Their main concern should be, according to the people who made this world, it should be to get rid of their major flaws, live in peace and harmony, improve their personalities considerably, do everything that very few people do on Earth. But there are always people who had power on Earth and who want it there, or people who didn't have power but would like to get it. What you can see that I'm driving towards is the need to get rid of the desire for power.
With the Riverworld series, Farmer could write about any historical figure he wanted, not just Mark Twain and Sir Richard Francis Burton, but Hermann Goering and Tom Mix and Jesus. They all showed up on the banks of Riverworld. Farmer used this mashup approach throughout his fiction. And Gary Wolfe says his combining of different genre elements and ideas paved the way for younger authors of what's sometimes called slipstream or interstitial fiction.
I've talked to more young writers in the last couple of years who are just gushing about how much he's influenced them. And 20 years ago, I didn't see very many writers like that. 20 years ago, people liked Phil's work, they admired it, they thought it was great, but that he was completely his own person and could never be imitated. I think now you have a lot of younger people who are doing that.
My last interview with Farmer was in 1999, the year his last new novel was published. After that, increasingly ill health ended his writing career. Once Farmer stopped writing, his books began to disappear from bookstores. His current publishers are mostly small specialty houses. But Gary Wolfe says Philip Jose Farmer will have a lasting influence among writers who challenge the conventions of genre, even if they've never read his work. I'm Jim Meadows.
Thanks to WCBU Radio in Peoria for permission to use interviews originally recorded for that station. And to learn more about Philip Jose Farmer, go to the author's website at www.pjfarmer.com. You're listening to Sidetrack. Sometimes something as simple as a card can reveal the timeless nature of family ties. More from essayist Christine Cleary.
My cousin B, visiting from New York, brings along a worn prayer card from the funeral of my grandmother, who died in 1937 at age 44 from an infection caused by a cat scratch. She left behind her broken-hearted husband and four children. That's when Grandpa moved his family from a rented flat in Manhattan to a house on Judge Street in Elmhurst, Queens, to live with his widowed sister-in-law and her own four children. My grandmother had immigrated to New York in 1910 from Ballyhaunis in County Mayo, Ireland, with her three sisters. Many years later, my own sisters and I loved our mother's stories about County Mayo, God help us, the native land of her parents. Why was it called that, Mom? We asked. Because Mayo is a very poor place, she said, just a craggy patch of land in the west of Ireland. The soil is rocky, not lush and green, like you imagine Ireland to be. Back then, only one or two of a typical Irish family's many children would inherit the farm. The rest had to emigrate, and could count on an American citizenship as a reward for their grueling journey across the Atlantic by boat. Five of the eight children in the house on Judge Street were young women, sharing one bathroom as they got ready for work. Someone would be in the tub, another on the toilet, and another at the sink, in rotation. Then they would comb out the curls created by bobby pins, slide into silky seam stockings, step into high-heeled shoes, pull dresses over their heads, apply cherry red lipstick and a dot of perfume, gather up their handbags, and dash out to the subway stop to catch a train into Manhattan. From a neighboring house, my father and his brother observed with delight as their new neighbors passed by, heels clicking on the pavement. It was my mother, a sparkly Irish girl with long, slim legs, black hair, and large brown eyes, who caught my father's eye and kept it for more than 50 years. Ethnic markets line the streets of Elmhurst now, and for today's immigrants, the path to U.S. citizenship is more arduous. But the family ties are the same. A key turns in a lock. A light is switched on. Water runs in the bathroom. Milk and bread are brought home from the market. Someone dies young, and the house holds the sound of weeping. A family comes and goes, kisses on the cheek, hello, goodbye, I love you. Different languages, same meaning. A sea breeze blows across the corner of Judge Street and Elmhurst Avenue, and a young man notices a young woman strolling by, earphones in her ears. And so it begins.
That essay from Christine Cleary. That story was produced by Robert Smith. you've got attuned to Sidetrack. Picture an irreverent big brother who's been there, done that, and surprisingly lived to tell the tales. Drummer Martin Atkins played for such bands as Public Image Limited, Ministry, Killing Joke, and Nine Inch Nails, and in that time has learned a thing or two about the music business. In addition to being an artist in his own right, he also owns the Invisible record label, teaches various marketing courses at Columbia College in Chicago, and has written the book Tour Smart and Break the Band. Independent producer Katie Ball talked with Atkins about lessons learned on the road and advice for bands out there today.
As a musician and the owner of a record label, you've seen music and the music business from just about all sides. So say with like your experience with Public Image Limited, business-wise, what would you say you all did right?
What did we do right? Nothing.
Not a thing?
Absolutely nothing, which is a lesson in and of itself. We did a five-week tour of America where we did 12 shows in 5 weeks. We didn't have any T-shirts for sale. We all had our own hotel suites. We arrived in Boston 4 days before the first show. Musically, the band was groundbreaking, but in so many other ways, I think Pill was victim to a lot of inexperience and naivete on our own part, but there was a lot of good things that went with that. The Metal Box, that album came out in 1979, was 3 12-inch vinyl singles in a metal film canister. It was a nightmare. It was easily dented. It cost a lot of money to produce.
It was clever in theory.
But right. And so 30 years later, it's still a talking point. So there aren't business efficiencies or ergonomic workflow efficiencies when it comes to culture and music and the things that pull on the essence of people's souls. You know, you can't quantify it and put it down on a spreadsheet, except if I had to quantify it, I would say it's going to take you more time, more effort, more energy, more blood to achieve something that transcends time a little bit.
In your book, you really are straight up about the pros and the cons of going on the road, but you're also emphatic about the fact that that's really imperative, that you have to go on the road to hope to become financially sustainable. But what do you think the biggest misstep, bands first, you know, out on the road, what do you think their biggest mistake is?
There are many easily avoidable mistakes that new bands make. If I wrote a book like this in any other field, like eye surgery, I mean, eye surgery has progressed incrementally every year for the last 50 years. Touring hasn't. You know, you still got bands making the same mistakes that Bill Haley and the Comets probably made. I still see bands trying to get an extra six-pack from a promoter, you know, harassing a promoter. Well, a six-pack's $5, just go buy one. You know, if you want to harass a promoter, harass them for something meaningful like another show on a better night. Just choose your battles and choose them wisely.
You mentioned once before about MySpace, and you were saying that, you know, MySpace is like a band being in, what was it, like an ear of corn and fields of corn.
Right, in a 7 mile long field of corn.
Right, just not standing out at all. And do you think that's a big misconception that some artists make these days, that they think because of the internet that they've got it all sewn up?
Yeah, I think that some people just genuinely think that it's an answer. And Barack Obama didn't just launch a MySpace campaign.
Right.
He went everywhere.
It was a bit more involved than that.
Right. And you could see a point where a politician might fail simply because they might lose their voice, you know. and not be able to communicate and look people directly in the eye and touch people. And sometimes politicians don't always touch people in a good way when they're out on the campaign right. trail. But I think they know that they have to go out there and touch people.
Yeah. Press the flesh, right? Wasn't that the term?
Yeah, yeah. And in my book, I call this shoot the dolphin. The movement that a dolphin makes coming in and out of the water is exactly what an artist needs to do, not going between air and water, but going between the physical and the digital elements. And the best promotion for a digital campaign, like a website or any of that online stuff, is to be out there in the physical domain and wave the flag and tell people about what you're doing and meet them. And
have them become invested in you, right?
Absolutely. And then the website will tell them about your next concerts, and you just bounce between the two domains, and one fuels the other. Then you don't need to have a physical album anymore. Your album can be downloaded. But here's an interesting thing. Like the Metal Box, you know, there was a fight that broke out in 1979 between a house full of punks who were baking a huge cookie in the lid of the Metal Box, which has the PIL logo embossed in it. So they were fighting over who got the cookie in the middle that had the upside down pill logo on it.
That's great.
Right, so it creates a story, and a story creates attention, and attention is what you need if anybody's going to go to your website and think about downloading your music. So it's physical packaging that communicates who you are, what your music is. If you don't care, then your packaging will be crap, lackluster, you know, just a two-page insert in a plastic jewel case.
If you don't care, why should anyone else, right?
Exactly. Your DNA is nowhere to be found in a shrink-wrapped jewel case, clinically clean product. You need to get as much of your DNA without causing a biohazard, as much of your DNA on your physical release as you possibly can. Stay away from pills. If you use cocaine, we're goodbye to your brain. If you use cocaine, we're goodbye to your brain. If you use cocaine, we're goodbye to your brain.
Do you think that artists in general have a tendency for maybe self-sabotage when it comes to success? Do you think that some do?
Yeah. I've seen it a lot. I played in Killing Joke for a few years there. I played in the band and co-produced an album with them. And they were actually on schedule to appear on Top of the Pops, which is the English American Bandstand. And the singer jumped on a plane to Iceland. Yeah, and it's like, of course he did. You know, I mean, at the time, I was thinking to myself, what am I doing joining this band that if it continues to succeed, this is what happens, you know? But the more you're in the business, and I don't know if I'm insightful or I've just been in the business a long time without dying. You see all of this stuff. But just to kind of let artists off the hook a little bit, because I am one myself, part of being contrary is essential, because there are so many bands who've been told, you're rubbish, this is music is new and different and it will never succeed. And they carry on anyway, and they prove people wrong. So after years of doing the opposite of what they're supposed to do sometimes, you know, you can kind of understand that when an artist is supposed to show up at the Academy Awards or, you know, at their record release party at some triumphant event, they do the opposite. You know, but I mean, that I have seen more artists do more to damage their own careers than somebody who was actively trying to sabotage their career could have done.
That's really got to be difficult, especially to see somebody that's really got a lot of promise, and whether it's, you know, drugs or just taking their craft for granted. Is that really difficult for you to see sometimes?
Yes, it always is. I will always be drawn to the charismatic screw up, you know. I mean, and as much as an educator, a manager, a label owner, as much as you would like an artist to be clean, smell nice, punctual, polite, I mean, we all know that those aren't the qualities that make for those artists that speak to people and get under your skin and make you want to join their crusade, you know. And it's trying to find artists who will at least try and understand themselves. I think then at least you have a chance.
Let's talk about, because you talk a lot about networking and marketing in the book, but in addition to the marketing aspects, you kind of talk about community kind of building efforts, you know, things like, if you're the opening band, you know, don't slag anybody on stage. Don't be rude to the sound tech, you know? I think that's really, really important, but what about, say, if, it does become known, like there's a club that's particularly shady with bands, or there's a, you know, a band that could be on a co-bill that are prima donnas. I mean, do you feel like it's important for bands to kind of look out for each other in some capacity?
Right, yeah, but there's a way of doing it. Why don't we ever hear of a story of the lead guitarist or the singer from band A contacts bands B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, S, and they go to the venue that's ripped each of them off,
right,
and demand that they be compensated.
They don't organize.
Right. People have as much power in any situation as they want to have. And if a band are being prima donnas, if I was in another band, I would try and take the high road and just be satisfied in the knowledge that sooner or later, and it's probably going to be sooner, the band that shouldn't have got that gig, that are prima donnas, are going to totally screw up in a really spectacular way. And much better for them to do it on their own without any help from another local band.
Like you say in the book, the karma is alive and well.
Right. And, you know, there's a bunch of pay-to-play going on for bands, and it encourages one band's audience to leave immediately after the band they've come to see, which is, it's counterproductive.
And very uncool.
I think right. And the greatest things happen by accident. I was at South by Southwest last year, and I saw my favorite band because I went to the wrong venue at the wrong time. And I saw this great band from England called the Victorian English Gentlemen's Club. Fantastic. You know, the greatest things happen by accident. And if eight bands are playing on a bill together, I understand where one way for the fans of the third band to show that they're there for the third band is to come into the venue as the third band starts playing, but then also to leave once the third band stops playing. And, you know, that has to stop. You know, all eight bands should encourage their audiences to stay for the entire show. And it's good for the bands, because the bass player in band number three might not like being in band number three. And when he sees band number six, he's like, wow, that's the kind of band I want to be in. If you're not seeing the eight bands performing with you one night, you're depriving yourself and your audience.
Well, plus there's the whole thing of when anyone assumes that they know it all, you immediately stop learning. You stop growing.
Right. And you know what? I've been teaching for 5 or 6 years now, and one of the happiest results of that is that I've learned so much. In simply verbalizing the lessons I'd learned and then writing my book and then continuing to learn as I start to teach different classes and stay involved, I'm learning my own lessons that I'd forgotten. And now I'm learning new lessons and learning from my students, and we're all learning together, you know. And anybody who thinks they know it all, I mean, they're just inches away from a huge catastrophe, because they don't know it all. They're going to need help, and people are less likely to give help to some self-righteous know-it-all than someone who's genuinely involved in trying to learn and pass on information. I started teaching, and I couldn't find a book that said the stuff that needed to be said. And I got what amounts to a textbook very quickly, and because I was creating new lesson plans for my business of touring class. But then I realized that there was so much more from the world of touring that wasn't in the book, like sex and drugs, like the human sacrifice, the stress, the invisible glue that holds all of this stuff together. And then I started to reach out to people I knew in the business, like Jason Pettigrew, the senior editor of Alternative Press magazine. I started to use the leverage I had to try and say, okay, what do you want to hear? What's good and bad? You know, managers, agents, venue owners, tell me what you'd like to hear from a band. I mean, it's all in there. The very cool thing that's happening now is bands are taking some of my strategies, or some of the strategies I've written about, and using them and writing back to me saying, wow. You know, one learning experience that comes to mind is a band called Sheep on Drugs. They actually stole one of those charity buckets, and they painted on the front, Sheep on Drugs Alcohol Fund, please give generously. And they put it at their merchandise booth. And people would just see that and laugh and put 50 cents or a dollar in. And they made $25 or $30 a night.
That's perfect.
So I put that in my book as really as an example of, like, you know, you can learn something from even a bunch of drunken lunatics from England, you know. And a band just wrote me and they said, that was such an easy thing for us to do. We got between $8 and $15 a night, and it made the difference between us eating or not. They got through their first 10-day tour, and the guy said to me, if they hadn't have had that $8, $10, $12 each night and been able to eat, they probably wouldn't have made it through the tour, and it would have been the end of the band. So, how cool is that?
That was drummer, teacher, and writer Martin Atkins. He talked with independent producer Katie Ball. Now, another story about drummers. Recently, the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts hosted its Day of the Drum event, which featured drummers from around the world, as well as one popular drummer from here in town, event curator Rocky Moffitt. Moffitt stopped by the WILL studios last month to talk drums with WILL-FM's Kevin Kelly as part of the show Live and Local. Moffitt was first asked how he got into music and drumming.
I guess you would say it started with the Ed Sullivan Show and the Beatles, because that was when I really first heard music that changed my life. And even though Ringo wasn't my favorite Beatle, there's something about the drumming that really appealed to me. And so before that, I was one of those nervous kids that drummed on everything in sight. And my parents, they bought me a set of drums for Christmas one year.
Standard drum set.
Well, far from standard. It had a snare and a bass drum and cymbals, but all of them were from different times and time periods. I mean, it's like I had a marching bass drum and this ancient brass snare and these cymbals that had rivets in them. you know. But I could really make a big clatter on them. And so I just started playing those. And then I sort of went to the school of RCA Victor. So I listened to all these records and I just copied the records. And I played drum set for a long time.
And then after the drum set, you eventually got into this thing of found percussion, which you've done a lot with.
Yeah. I think a lot of that comes out of the Brazilian tradition, which is that a lot of the Brazilian percussive music was made by people who didn't have money to buy instruments, so they created their own, invented their own. And I fell in love with Brazilian music in the 70s. There was one particular musician named Ayrton, who was a percussionist who played with people like Miles Davis and Weather Report and Chick Corea and all these people. And his approach to percussion transcended the drum set. So you would have all of these other kinds of instruments, friction drums, different tuned bells, lots of different kinds of shakers, something called a beat-em-bow, which is a musical bow. And it was a collection of sounds rather than an ensemble that you played in pretty much the same way all the time.
So you discovered this guy through the records, through jazz.
Then I went to see him and went and then got hungry to hear about other Brazilian music. Then I moved to Boston, and I got to study with a Brazilian percussionist there. And that kind of changed things for me.
And how did you manage, what do you think it was about listening to Weather Report and Miles Davis, where most other people would focus on very different instruments that would jump out to them, but somehow this sound jumped out to you?
Well, I was already pretty rhythmically fluent, and I was never going to be Joe Zawinul on the keyboard. I was never going to be Wayne Shorter on the saxophone. But I could do that percussion thing. I could figure that out. And basically, I just wanted to play with the best musicians I could find, the best musicians available. And I found that there was less competition in the realm of being an ancillary percussionist than there was for being the drum set player.
And what would you say you do for a living now?
I'm an ancillary percussion player. I do a lot. It's sort of a crazy quilt of things. I do workshops. I do performances in schools. I do stage performances. I write songs.
And you brought along, it looks to me, like a couple of frame drums.
I did.
In fact, they look to me like big tambourines without the jingles.
That's a good way to put it. That's a perfect description of a frame drum. The technical definition would be that the circumference of the head is larger than the depth of the frame. Okay? So the tambourine, which I didn't bring one, is a perfect example of a frame drum. And tambourines are found in just about every rhythmic culture across the world, some version of the tambourine. Thank you.
So the one you just, this drum is called a what?
It's called a bendir.
How do you spell that?
B-E-N-D-I-R.
And you brought along another instrument that looks like a smaller version of what you have, but it really isn't at all. Or I guess it is and it isn't.
It is. It's still a frame drum, but it's called an ocean drum.
And O-C-E-A-N, just like
the ocean. Because
yeah.
it has two heads. And what is key to the sound is what's inside the drum, which are these BBs, metal pellets, that when you lay the drum flat in your hands and then you make this motion like you're panning for gold, the BBs swirl around the inside of the drum, resonating on both heads, and it emulates the sound of the ocean.
And it's going to sound different depending on which direction you have the thing turned.
Yes, and then if that's all you did with it, that would be nice. But it's also a fantastic drum with amazing possibilities in terms of just how you play it.
Well, let's just hear a little of the basic sound just to get an idea of the ocean sound. Now, what if you flip it the other way?
Similar.
So it's a slightly different color.
Now, what I like about this, Kevin, is just the idea that somebody's turning on WILL today and they think something's wrong with their radio.
Okay, so you also brought this thing that... Okay, I'm going to describe it as a cross between a large gourd, a ceramic pot, and an alien pod.
I think that's a really good description.
Thank you.
It's all clay, and it's from a group of drums called Udu drums. Udu means clay in a Nigerian tongue that I can't remember the name of right off the top of my head.
And that's spelled U-D-U.
U-D-U. And usually it's in the shape of a big vase, and then it has this hole in the center. I'm just going to pick this up.
Actually, there's two holes in this thing.
In this one, there's two holes because it's this unusual design. So you have one hole that has this, you have the actual pot sound, and then you have this big bass hole here. And then we have a second hole. So we have two. Like that.
Bass and treble all in one instrument.
Bass and treble all in one. And they also have a similar instrument in India called a hatam, which is spelled G-H-A-T-A-M. And there'll be a quiz afterwards. So, yeah, but the udu's a great drum to play. It sings. It has this great sort of breath quality to it, especially because of the bass notes.
Well, let's hear it. And I got a question for you when we're done.
Okay. Thank you.
That was local drummer Rocky Moffitt. He came by the WILL studios to talk with WILL FM host Kevin Kelly for the show Live and Local, which airs weekdays at noon. Before Moffitt left, he put down the drums and picked up a guitar for a song.
So this is back in the day. The radio's on and the song is a song they were singing back in the day. You live with your father and mother who bothered to teach back in the day what was right, what was wrong. And they thought we'd carry it on. Maybe we just got carried away back in the day. We can remember the toys of December and Christmas back in the day. The toys and the sweaters, the cars and the letters when we were back in the day. Will our kids feel the same? Will they think the world's gone insane? And nothing's as good, good as it was back in the day.
Local musician Rocky Moffitt, recorded live in the WILL studios. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.